Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How smart are we when we decide what and how to eat? Is it possible to eat healthfully without sacrificing flavor, texture, and satisfaction? Peter Kerminsky has written about food for decades, contributing regularly to Food and Wine, The New York Times, and New York Magazine. Not surprisingly, he loved the job, but over time, his attraction to rich foods and strong flavors began to take a toll. By the time he turned 50, he had put on more than 20 extra pounds, and his doctor was worried about his cholesterol and blood sugar levels. So Kerminsky decided to make some changes, but he knew he wouldn't be happy eating so-called diet foods for the rest of his life. Instead, he sought ways to pack maximum flavor into every bite he took and discovered he could reduce the amount he ate without compromising taste. His latest book is Culinary Intelligence, The Art of Eating Healthy and Really Well. It's now available in paperback. Peter, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you. Good to be here.
So it would definitely be wrong to call this a diet book. Do you have a better phrase to characterize it?
Let me see. A good eating book, a fun eating book.
Yeah, it's funny about...
A healthy eating book.
Yeah. And somehow, I'm wondering if people are having trouble deciding which shelf to put this on, because it seems like today there is the shelf for people who say, eat what you love, don't worry about the effects on your body, and other people who say, for God's sake, don't eat stuff that might make you happy, think only about taste.
Well, the thing is, there are, especially in an era of processed food, they've discovered... The ubiquitous they, how to pump up flavor by stripping out nutrients and, chemicalizing the food we eat. And it can be delicious. So good tasting doesn't necessarily mean good for you. However, if you use natural, whole ingredients and prepare them well, they are going to be good tasting. And the satisfaction you get, I think, will keep you from running to the potato chip bag.
So this is really interesting. Some musicians are gifted with perfect pitch. You have something like a perfect palate. Can you talk about that and how it sort of played into your interest in food and your work with food?
Well, I've always been able to taste. I can pretty much taste the ingredients and tell you what's in a dish most of the time. I mean, if it's a 40-ingredient Indian curry, I'm going to be stumped. Most of the things we eat, I'm quite sensitive to, and I guess that's why I've always cooked and always been interested in food. I remember traveling in France with a great French chef now in New York, Daniel Boulud, and being served some stuff at these fancy restaurants and being able to pick out the flavors and what they were, and Danielle raising his eyebrow as if to say, good job.
But you did not only delight in rarefied fare. You, like the rest of us, you admit you got a little thrill from Ben & Jerry's, from French fries, that sort of thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, here's the hitch. Now, French fries in and of themselves are not unhealthful. Neither is Ben & Jerry's. However, they pack a lot of calories. Mm-hmm. So, unless there's a real reason to eat them, I don't. Mm-hmm. I don't. I think a cup of ice cream every day watching the ball game is not going to take off any pounds. So I like it, but I don't eat it that much.
So talk about how you decided that when you wanted to lose some weight, you had to work with rather than against your love of food.
Well, denial is not a diet plan, or not one that most people can effectively follow. So I had to achieve satisfaction out of what I was eating. And I just discovered I've always cooked. And I think that's important for controlling your weight and your diet. You're not going to lose weight or maintain a healthy weight with a steady diet of takeout food and restaurants. Restaurants are fun. They're great. It's a nice place to celebrate. But, as an every night thing, it will definitely pack on the pounds. So basically, I looked at what the whole ingredients were that I really like and how to cook with them. I like meat. I like vegetables. I love tomatoes. I love anchovies. I love Parmesan cheese. So there, you know, there are great whole ingredients. And when they're vegetables, if they contain fiber, which vegetables do, or fruits rather than juices, it slows down the absorption of the carbohydrates that turn to sugar, which turns to fat. So a lot of advice from anecdotal advice from friends, from my mom, and then reading and talking to experts like Marion Nessel, chairman of the Nutritional Studies Department at NYU, and Walter Willett at Harvard, and I just cast about and finally figured out what to do. The piece of advice that made me lose the weight the quickest, here's what happened. I was up for life insurance, and my blood sugar was high, and I got rejected. Mm-hmm. So the guy who sold me the life insurance said, listen, I'm diabetic, and what I did was I cut out, potatoes and white flour and, processed white ingredients. Now, everyone who's ever been on a checkout line at a supermarket probably knows that part of a healthy diet by now by heart. I didn't. I guess I don't look at the magazines at checkout lines. So I cut that out. I cut the wine down to a glass rather than more than a glass, and everyone lies about how much, or fibs to themselves about how much more they drink. If anyone says about a glass, that means two. and the weight started to come off. In fact, it was during this time that I wrote a cookbook called Seven Fires with a great Argentinian grill chef, Francis Malman. And I also did a dessert book with Michel Richard, just tasting, not eating them all. And over that 6 months, I lost 20 pounds. So it sure worked for my metabolism. It's amazing how it peels the weight off.
And ultimately, what you want to do when you eat something is you want to get the maximum flavor per calorie.
That's what I call it, FPC. I don't think there's any other way around it. If you don't get it, you're going to seek it out in less healthful, high-caloric food. Mm-hmm. No question about it. So the more you can maximize the amount of flavor in each bite, the more satisfied you'll be. I can tell you about a test that we did with some chefs and food writers in New York with some beef that was really interesting.
Yeah.
There's a place called Prime Meats and Frankie Spuntino that's gets a lot of press. Maybe you've read about it in Texas. And so I had some discussions with some people in the meat business about grass-fed versus grain-fed beef. And I wasn't convinced on their grain-fed side of the argument, because grass-fed beef tends to be leaner. It has a different kind of fat in it. And I got used to it doing my Argentine book in South America, where it's all grass-fed. So we tested. I sent out the word to a bunch of beef producers and the American Grass Farmer magazine, and I got signed up 7 producers. And over 2 tastings, we did we did ribeyes and strip steaks, or mm-hmm. New York cut steaks. The clear winner, it was all blind tasting, was a 100% grass-fed, grass-finished ribeye from upstate New York from a hay farmer named Rosencrantz. It's just wonderful beef. And he was able to age it, which is hard to do with a grass-fed animal because it's leaner. You get what's called drip. It starts to lose moisture and weight. So it's uneconomical. However, these guys, I guess they're deer hunters too. They just aged it, the whole carcass, like you would a deer in deer season.
Just put the whole thing in cold storage.
Yeah, and it worked. So we loved that. And our second favorite was a grass-fed, so it had that kind of muscle developed, and then grain-finished, aged for 35 days. And again, that's where you get a lot of that flavor per calorie from the aging. It makes it nice and funky and just wonderful. So here's the thing I discovered. You can order, you know, a cheapo commodity steak in a restaurant, or you pick one up at the supermarket, and you're gonna have a pound steak there. You're probably gonna eat the whole thing, because it doesn't really hit the spot for all that beefy taste and wonderfulness. However, three slices of a ribeye, you know, a thick ribeye, mm-hmm. you're done. You're absolutely done. We all were done, and I'm still done when I eat that stuff. It just hits the spot, as I say, satisfies me, and it's delicious. So you don't need to eat that pound of meat.
Well, you know, what's
Nobody
interesting,
needs to eat that pound of meat.
Yeah, what's interesting about that, Peter, is I think even about, you know, people who worry that eating the best ingredients will mean they're paying an unaffordable amount of money for food. And we don't want to make light of people struggling to put any food on the table at all. But, you know, you could get, like, again, the, you know, 18-ounce steak at Applebee's or whatever, and need to eat the whole thing or eat three of them, you know, 3 weeks in a row, as compared with going out one time and eating something really good.
Or cooking it at home.
Yeah, yeah.
And best ingredients doesn't mean truffles and foie gras. I mean, I had some, believe it or not, boiled radishes at this farmer's, Paul Willis, in Thornton, Iowa, founded the Nyman Ranch Pork Company. And lo and behold, boiled radishes in salt water just out of the ground were amazing. They just were amazing. I had no idea they were radishes. I didn't know what the hell they were. A turnip can be great. If you want to eat some potatoes, you know, some nice, you know, fingerlings are delicious. Cost doesn't need to be the barrier here. Not everybody can afford the priciest ingredients, but I don't think the priciest ingredients are necessary. They're fun, but they're not necessary.
I always wonder about that with regard to olive oil, because every chef worth his or her salt says, get the very best olive oil you can afford. And I'm not sure I know if I'm getting what I'm paying for.
Good point. I don't know how to tell you. I guess you have to go by reputation.
Mm-hmm.
You got to look on the web. You can talk to some chefs if you know any, or great home cooks. Or anybody who's came from or is second generation Italian or Spanish or Greek or Turkish, they know good olive oil. And, you know, it's just stay with the one that's delicious. But you also, anybody can tell if it's delicious. If it ain't delicious and it costs a lot, it's not worth it.
Mm-hmm.
If it is delicious, then you can make up your mind. And no, and listen, nobody drinks a half a bottle of olive oil at dinner. You know, you're talking about a tablespoon.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes a long way.
My guest is author Peter Kaminsky. He's written for Food and Wine, The New York Times, and New York Magazine. He's former managing editor of National Lampoon. His latest book, now out in paperback, is called Culinary Intelligence, The Art of Eating Healthy and Really Well.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Peter Kaminsky. He's written for The New York Times, New York Magazine, Food and Wine. He's former managing editor of National Lampoon. His new book is called Culinary Intelligence, The Art of Eating Healthy and Really Well. It's just been re-released in a paperback edition. So, Peter, the reason that many people crave meat is this sort of flavor known as umami, which the Japanese identified some time ago, and Americans are just starting to fully understand and embrace.
That's true. I like the translation of the word. It means delicious or yummy. And, you know, you can't really pick it up on your tongue, or we tend not to, the way you do something salty or sour or sweet or bitter. But it's one of the five taste receptors you have on your tongue, and you even have some on your stomach. And I went to dinner with Charles Zucker, who's the scientist who identified that taste bud. It took us a long time, Lord knows, to do it, but now we know where it is and how it works. Here's what I think umami is. For the most part, it tells us that there's accessible protein in the food that you're about to eat. And, you know, protein is tremendously important, you know, scarcer in times when human beings were evolving. So it's very important that they get it when they could. Meat has a lot of umami in it. Fish has umami. I mean, animal flesh has umami, although some vegetables have it as well. Cheese, aged cheese has it. You even have some in red wine. So I'm all for that. But that's what I think it is. It's this super savory sense that it's a signal to your body that the thing I'm tasting now has got a mess of protein in it and it's going to be good for me. And when you really eat it in its concentrated form, like a beautifully reduced chicken stock, well, it's funny. The feeling I get is, you know, when you like smile a lot or laugh a lot, you feel this kind of you know, little fatigue or good tiredness in your mm-hmm. temples. I guess because your face muscles have been lifting for a while.
Yeah.
What with really powerhouse umami, I get that feeling.
Huh.
So I don't know if that, you know, I could tell you what sweet is like and what salty is like, and everybody would know. But it's a little more subtle as a flavor, but your body does pick it up, and it's very important.
So your business card would, if you listed all the things that you have done and are doing, it would run off the tiny little piece of cardboard. But the other thing I think you should add on there is champion of tiny fishes, because you remind us how delicious things like sardines and anchovies can be that a lot of us just assume are not really worthy of a regular diet.
That's true. You know, The French, the Italians, the French with their bouillabaisse, the Italians with their rodettos, I forget what it's called in Spain. You know, that mix of that stew that mixes a lot of little fishes is very popular, and it's very healthy. The problem is not that salmon or tuna or striped bass or redfish, to name four really popular fish, are unhealthful for you. They're good for you. But the oceans, at the current rate of fish catching, cannot sustain wild fisheries for very much longer. The commonly accepted estimate is we're going to be out of wild fish by 2048. And that's because we largely, or in part, because we eat these glamour fish. The ones that you see on restaurant menus. Now, the ocean is full of all kinds of edible, different-sized fishes. And I think one thing you can do to vary your diet, to lower the hit to your pocketbook, and to help the oceans is to eat a wide variety of fish. So it's as simple as that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Maggie in Fort Worth. Hi, Maggie.
Hello.
Hi.
My list has grown. I've listened to you talk. It's just, I love this. I'm going to run out and get this book. I'm an organic gardener, and I find that my taste, my palate has changed over the years. I'm in my 50s. I like hotter, spicier foods now than I did younger, and I grow them. My crop is a lot depending on those stronger flavors. Also, of course, you get more flavor from vine-ripe tomatoes and eggplants you pick, and then you go in and cook. Your comment on umami, I was just thinking to myself that the perfect moment that I experienced that is when I have cooked something that has beef in it, but is all of my peppers and onions and garlic and tomato, and then I find exactly the right red wine, and it's that sip of wine that tells me, ah, this is it. And so it sounds like it's my discovery of what you're talking about. But I'm curious. My real question is, I find that a lot of things in the grocery store tend to be shifting towards milder flavors. A Mexican friend was telling me the poblano peppers aren't as hot as they used to be. And I find that there are more sweet onions that don't have the tear factor and they don't have as strong a flavor. And I'm trying to grow the stronger flavored ones. How do you respond to this? What are you finding in the marketplace as far as what GMO or what hybrids are doing to the food taste?
Well, a lot of questions in that GMO is genetically modified organisms, and hybrids that are in vegetables and fruits that are bred for the ability to resist bruising and to ripen slowly when they're shipped. I don't know. I don't trust them. I don't trust any of them. It took so many millions of years for human beings and the foods they depend on to evolve. I mean, they're really complex, and they're really good. The things that we really like in their natural state are really good for us. So I tend to stay away from the hybrids and definitely the genetically modified stuff because I'm afraid we're going to release, you know, a plague of giant man-eating tomatoes on the planet today if we keep doing that. So that's part of it. As to what I'm finding, well, gardening, which I wish I had a garden here in Brooklyn, but I don't, although a lot of people have them on their rooftops now, gardening is great. The shorter the amount of time between the soil to your plate, the more full-tasting and satisfying that fruit or vegetable is going to be. So I think that's important. When I started this book, I have to remember now, I think there were something like 3,500 farmers markets in America. And when by the time it was published, it was over 8,000. So in the growing season, there are, you know, so many places in America now where you can buy fresh, just picked fruits and vegetables. So that, if you're not growing, I think that's a great alternative. You know, if you don't have either, look for the organic stuff in your supermarket. Even though it could be organic and shipped from Chile, at least it's organic. And you'll know by trial and error which supermarkets you can trust as to how much flavor it delivers. So that's what I have to say about, you know, the problem of finding good stuff. It's out there. You know, either grow your own or patronize your local farmers. And when you find one who's really good, a farmer, keep buying from them because not everything in a green market is going to be terrific.
I was going to say, if we go all the way to the farmer's market, and for some people it's really close, and for some people it's a little further, maybe farther than the nearest grocery store, but it's worth then being picky once you arrive and making sure that you've tasted what you're about to buy.
Absolutely. You know, people think once they go to a farmer's market, they've sort of voted for good nutrition and, you know, and morality. But that's not the end of the story. I can go to a market, you know, like the big market in Union Square in Manhattan, although I usually patronize my local markets in Brooklyn. But you can go to one. Let's say when peaches are in season or strawberries are in season. Well, if it's the first strawberries I've seen that this year, and there's some from upper New York State where it's cooler and a little bit more altitude, and there's some, let's say, from southern New Jersey where it's warmer and lower, I would buy the southern New Jersey ones, you know, on that first trip, because they're the ones that are really going to be ripe and mature and beautiful. Then as strawberry season progresses, which is, you know, about 2-3 weeks, I'll, you know, at the end of it, I'll go for the northern stuff, because the southern stuff's going to be mushy and, you know, sort of overripe by then. So, you know, you have to think about what's in your area and where the farmers are coming from. And then you got to taste. I find most farmers or vendors at these markets will let you have a taste of stuff. And that's the best way to decide what's great. You know, it's a good vegetables are going to be like waking up from a great nap. You know, you just feel terrific. And if they don't want to let you taste, you can either roll the dice or just take your business elsewhere.
Talk about the flavor value of dried fruits.
Well, just like a stock that you reduce, dried fruit is reduced, so the flavors concentrate. You know, the trace elements and minerals that, you know, make a strawberry different than a blueberry will become more concentrated, and they're going to hit your palate more forcefully. And, of course, the sugar, which is the reason we like fruit to begin with, is going to get more concentrated.
You know, when you talked earlier, Peter, about eating a little bit of really good beef or a lot of sort of mediocre beef, it made me think it's sort of the same thing with a lot of not so great, not so pungent chocolate, or eating a little bit of dark chocolate.
Well, I was born in the back of a candy store. My grandma's in Kearney, New Jersey. You know, raised on baseball cards. I mean, they fed me good food, but I, you know, grandma doting on her firstborn grandchild. I tended to get sweets when I wanted them, and you know, I'm a big chocoholic. I love it. Now, here's the deal: cheap chocolate that's made from, you know, cheap cacao beans. Is usually bitter. Most milk chocolate is made from very bitter nibs of cacao, those little things inside the seeds that are ground up. And therefore, in order to be palatable, they require a lot of sugar. Now, what some dark chocolate doesn't have all that powdered milk in it, which is, you know, you don't need, and it doesn't require the same amount of sugar, you know, if it comes from really, you know, good sources and good farms. And happily, we're seeing more and more of that these days. I went on a trip to Guatemala with John Scharfenberger. Perhaps your audience knows Scharfenberger chocolate. I quite love it. To visit some Mayan Indians whose beans he was interested in. And those beans have what are called very soft tannins, you know, that bitter astringent factor that you get in some chocolate. And that's his holy grail, to find cacao beans that will give you that smoothness of flavor on your palate and that wonderful nuttiness of chocolate, but don't require that much sugar. So it is like the beef. I buy some good 70 or 80% dark chocolate. That means 70% of that bar is just pure cacao, you know, a beautiful natural ingredient, and it has much less sugar. So two, three squares of that, you know, are nice, and you get that nice chocolate hit, which I'm told are happiness antidepressant drugs or chemicals that are natural to chocolate. And so that's what I do. It's just like the beef. Less is more. And better.
Where do you come down on coffee? Because it seems like this has become, like, for many people, almost like a fourth meal of the day with the amount of coffee we're downing, some of which may be, you know, calorically neutral, and some of which is loaded with sugar and fat.
Well, there's a lot of literature and studies coming out about coffee in the last few years. Coffee itself is pretty good for you. As you say, coffee all by itself is calorie neutral, and it hydrates you. I've seen recent studies that seem to indicate that it, you know, can help with concentration and stuff. But as Marion Nestle has said, the thing about scientific studies, because there's three, you know, a week, she said,
right.
for every PhD, there's an equal but opposite PhD, which I love, and it seems to be true. Now, what do you put in your coffee? Milk has lactose, which is a sugar, which naturally sweetens it. I prefer my coffee with some milk, period. And that's fine with me. I don't need the sugar in it. I'm well satisfied. You know, if you've been drinking it that way your whole life, you know, you might miss it. But I don't think you will for that long. Then it's a question of, you know, are you one of these, are you a modern cappuccino, latte, you know, macchiato drinker or not? No question about it that, you know, if you mix your espresso with, you know, a cup of milk, it's about 130 calories. And whereas if you drink, you know, normal coffee out of a coffee maker with just some milk to lighten it up and soften the taste, that's far fewer calories. So anyone who drinks, you know, four cappuccinos a day is getting, you know, a 33% more calories just out of coffee. So you have to ask yourself, do you need it?
Peter Kaminsky is with us. His new book is called Culinary Intelligence.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Peter Kaminsky. He has written a new book called Culinary Intelligence, The Art of Eating Healthy and Really Well. It's available now in a paperback edition. I thought this was interesting. You obviously have spent years eating in restaurants professionally. You say even before you order the food, you take the measure of a restaurant by observing how they serve their bread and butter.
Ah, yeah, it's true. I like bread, of course, and I love butter. You don't need, it's good, you don't need a lot to satisfy, especially at the beginning of a meal, don't fill up on that.
Mm-hmm.
You can, and it's just going to be lots of calories, and you're going to miss the good stuff that you came to the restaurant for. But that's it, I like a little bit. And butter, like, you know, Goldilocks's porridge, needs to be not too hard, not too soft, just right. When you go to a restaurant and they give you butter that's icy and sort of, you know, when you put your knife into it, it shatters,
right,
like a piece of hard chocolate. To me, that says, you know, they don't care that much. Someone comes into the restaurant and they just grab it out of the too cold fridge and just, you know, put it on the table. So not a lot of care or thought goes into it. And then even worse is butter that's too soft, because that means it's been sitting out. Again, it denotes a lack of carefulness and attention to what you're paying for, which is then to pay attention to good food for you. And I just have visions of...
what else,
you know,
is sitting out? Other,
yeah, what else is happening in that careless kitchen? So I just find... That a restaurant that serves that butter at just the right temperature, so it's firm but spreadable, means at least they paid attention to something that won't just show up that way all on its own. You need to pay attention And that tells me maybe they care about the other things they're doing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Dee on the line in Louisville. Hi, Dee.
Hello, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Good. I just have a quick question. You know, you have to work in, and in the corporate section, it's very stressful. And I was wondering if there is any type of food or anything that I can do to stop craving for sugar. And it usually happens during a stressful day, and it's not healthy for me. So if you have any comments about that or any suggestions, I really would appreciate it.
Thanks for your call.
Stop your... Well, a couple things. One wonders if there's, you know, low blood sugar and it's a warning sign of diabetes. I'm not a physician by any means, but you never know if that's got part of it. Sugar is psychologically very satisfying. I mean, mother's milk, again, lactose, contains sugar in it, and we love that taste. It means quick energy, just naturally. However, when you get those cravings, how about a handful of almonds? Not sweet, and that protein in it, it's going to satisfy you really quickly. An apple. Yes, an apple is sweet, but it's also got some fiber in it, and it's got some vitamins, and it also fills you up. There's the idea of volumetrics. The amount of food you have in your stomach is also going to be a signal that you're satisfied. So I would look towards some fruits, some nuts, a pretzel. Ain't too bad. That's what I would do. And then see if that satisfies you. And if it doesn't, maybe have your blood sugar checked, I guess.
Something that stuck with me, I think when the book first came out, you gave an interview to the New York Times about it, and I suppose a reporter asked you about juice, which I know you don't drink, and you said when people say they're going on a juice cleanse, for you it's like the equivalent of a root beer cleanse. Can you talk about that?
Well, fruit, again, we like fruit because of the sugar in it. Fruit juice, but the fiber... in fruit means that you don't absorb all that sugar all at once and get a real spike in your blood sugar, which is going to end up messing up with insulin and things like that over time. So, just in nutritional terms, fruit juice is mostly water and sugar. Yes, there's some vitamins in it, but you can get your vitamins in other ways. So I don't fool yourself into thinking that you're going to drink your way to all the vegetables and fruits you need.
We have Jared on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jared.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I have a question, or maybe just your opinion. I have my father is a retired chief naval physician, and he has... In 1990, he was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin cancer, and it's gone into remission, as well as he has some other ailments. But the thing is he takes a handful of medications every day. But what he's made me, I think, maybe OCD about is taking supplements. So, of course, every morning I take a handful of supplements. But on top of that, I am... I also see patients myself, and I'm always on the go, but I want to make sure that I'm eating right, so I grab things that have artificial sweeteners in them, and I try to stay away from sugar as much as possible. Are there items besides just, I think you mentioned fruit juice, are there other items that I can add to my diet that may have proper sugar in them?
Well, like I said, if they're whole fruits... then they're going to have fiber, and you're going to absorb the sugar, more gradually. So that's quite good. What else was there? No, you said something else. Artificial sweeteners. I've read a number of studies that say that artificial sweeteners fool your tongue. but they don't fool your body. So in an odd way, you're going to end up, after eating eating things with artificial sweeteners in them, completely unsatisfied for sugar. If you want sugar before you ate the sweetener, you're going to want sugar after you ate it. They just, you know, quiet down your palate for a little bit. So I don't know that that's a solution. And like I said, you know, the on-the-go thing, there's nothing better than nuts. And you can get, you know, nuts and an apple at any 7-Eleven, at any, you know, Southland Dairy, at any, you know, gas station stop. Among the few really healthful non-processed foods you can pretty much find anywhere. So I hope that helps answer the question.
Peter, what do you like to eat for breakfast?
What do I like to eat for breakfast? I like an egg or two.
Mm-hmm.
I eat whole grain bread. I have an insanely great baker around the corner from me. So I buy his bread. And I'll often get some smoked salmon, you know, keep that around for a few days and have a slice of smoked salmon, you know, it's a good protein hit for breakfast. So I like that. I like, the whole oatmeal that takes a little while to cook. However, if you don't want to invest all the time, you can sort of soak it overnight and cut your cooking time down by 2/3. I like those things. I like yogurt, unsweetened yogurt, and then, you know, I'll mix it with some fruit. What else can I tell you? I like my cold cereals,
mm-hmm.
But I look for the whole grain stuff. Because refined flour, white flour, like fruit juice, it turns to sugar in your bloodstream faster than you can say refined flour and fruit juice. when you see cereals that say fortified with all these vitamins and contains protein, I always ask myself, why are they making these claims? What aren't they telling me? And what they're not telling me is it's a lot of white flour, so they're making up for it by making a combination, you know, vitamin pill and nutrient supplement. But the whole stuff, the whole grains, are what you want.
So if you've pretty much come down against refined flour and wheat products, what about pasta? Some people, you know, have cut out white bread, but they just can't do the whole grain pasta.
Well, there's a reason. It doesn't hold that slithery sauce, you know. It doesn't slide around as pleasantly on your tongue. Mm-hmm. When I first went into the diet or my change in diet, I cut out the white pasta. Then I read something. There's a thing called glycemic index,
right,
which is a measure of how quickly and how powerfully food is converted to sugar in your bloodstream. And hard durum semolina wheat, which most of the really good pastas are, cooked al dente, has a glycemic index about the same, it's been a while since I saw the numbers, but about the same as whole grain pasta. So you can eat it. Here's the trick. No one needs a half a pound of pasta. You'll never find that on a plate in Italy. You might not find it on four plates in Italy, but I tend to think that 4 ounces of pasta when it's all cooked with an equal amount of vegetables that are sautéed or, you know, or made into a sauce, is the real secret for getting fun out of pasta but not filling up on quick carbs. So, make sure your plate is equal amounts of pasta and vegetables mixed in with it, and you'll be doing fine.
So I grew up in a house where my dad was allergic to onions, so we never had them in anything. And it's been like the joy of my adult life to be cooking without him in the house and realize how great they are. And I was gratified to see these at the sort of the top of the list of the things you always start meals with, or often start meals with.
Yep. Mom and grandma, they had a very keen sense of onions. And I don't know. You know, they say when you want to sell a house, you should bake bread.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you want to make people happy in a house and hungry, you should be sautéing some onions.
That front door opens, yeah.
Sweet and come hither, and they just go with everything. Mm-hmm. And they have an affinity, they have an ability to accent whatever is sweet in the foods they're combined with, almost like a booster of the sense of sweetness without adding much sugar.
There's no hurry in getting them nice and caramelized, though.
Excuse me?
There's no way to hurry caramelizing onions. You need to take your time.
You do. But if you want, you know, a good shortcut, if you want brownness real quick, like if you want to get them, like you're roasting a chicken with some onions in the pan,
mm-hmm.
Or making a brisket or something, if you put the onions in a hot, dry frying pan, they'll start to almost burn, and they'll get some good brownness to them. And, you know, then you toss that in whatever you're cooking, and although it's not exactly the same, you get a good hit of that, whatever it is, goodness that browned onions have, and the color that you know, signals to you, oh boy, I want this.
Is Parmesan cheese like olive oil? Like you really ought to buy the very best you can possibly get your hands on.
I think that's true of everything. The best that you can afford.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start with that. Because not everybody has the same pocketbook. But, yeah, you know, again, you're not eating half a pound of Parmesan cheese. You're eating a tablespoon or so. So it really stretches. Saffron. Mm. You know, everyone says saffron is too expensive. I did a big story with a chef who cooks a lot of saffron from Spain. To make your average dish that calls for saffron, you're going to use about a buck's worth. So, you know, a dollar is not an awful lot to really pump up the flavor and satisfyingness of a recipe.
Peter Kaminsky's latest book is Culinary Intelligence, The Art of Eating Healthy and Really Well. It's available now in paperback. Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure. Thank you. And thank your callers, inners.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can download the podcast at kera.org/think and make a comment or ask a question by email to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.